not, I'd like to talk a little bit about happiness. The old view about Buddhism was that Buddhism was very pessimistic, talked nothing about suffering. There was even a belief that the Buddha taught that life is suffering, which he never taught. Nowadays, people are more aware of the fact that Buddhism teaches about happiness. But it still sounds very pessimistic, the kind of happiness that is usually attributed to what the Buddha taught. The idea being that seeing that all pleasures and pains are fleeting, so you have to just sort of accept the pleasure that it comes, accept the fact that it's going to go, take a little bit of sort of bittersweetness out of the pleasure before it goes. But that's very pessimistic, as if there was nothing but that you could really do to find a long-term happiness. And it's kind of defeatist. It's kind of the happiness of lower expectations. You know, like that Calvin Harps cartoon, where Calvin makes a snowman with two parts. He says, I think I'll stop here. And Hobbes says, remind me to invest overseas. The Buddha actually taught that wisdom begins with realizing that there's some forms of happiness that are longer lasting, better, more harmless than others. And they depend on your actions, the things that you do to bring them about. And so his attitude toward happiness is not that it's something that you just passively accept what's coming and what's going and be okay with that. But you look for the fact, what can I do that will bring about long-term welfare and happiness? In fact, that, he says, is the question that lies at the beginning of wisdom. You go to someone that you think is well-versed in these areas, and you ask that question, what will I do that will lead to long-term welfare and happiness? From the thinking about long-term happiness, you realize also that it has to require goodwill for others, that your happiness not depend on their suffering. The two passages in the canon that are relevant here. One, the Buddha himself said that when he started out on his path, he had this vision of the world being like a tiny stream, but the water was drying out, and they're still filled with fish. And the fish were fighting one another over that last little gulp of water, and then they were going to die. And everywhere he looked, he saw that everything was laid claim to. And where could you find a happiness that you wouldn't have to push someone away from something that they'd laid claim to? And it got him, gave him a strong sense of dismay. So the question is there happiness you can find that doesn't require taking things away from other people? And this relates also to another story in the canon, where King Basenadi, who was a king who would sometimes come and see the Buddha, was up in his inner apartments with Queen Malika, his favorite queen. And in a tender moment, he turns to her and he says, Malika, is there anyone in the world you love more than yourself? And you know what he's thinking. He wants her to say, yes, Your Majesty, I love you more than I love myself. And if this were a Hollywood movie, she probably might say that. But this is the Pali canon. And Malika's no fool. She says, no, there's nobody I love more than myself. And how about you? Anybody you love more than yourself? The king says, no. And so that's the end of that scene. And so the king goes down to see the Buddha and reports the conversation that he had with Malika. And the Buddha said, she's right. You could search the world over and not find anyone that you love more than yourself. And in the same way, other people are very fiercely in love with themselves. And the conclusion the Buddha draws from this is not that it's a dog-eat-dog world. Instead, he says, never harm anybody. In other words, if your happiness depends on their suffering, they're not going to stand for it. You have to find a happiness that doesn't harm anybody. And that's what the Buddha is offering in his teachings. And that question, what I do will lead to my long-term welfare and happiness, that can take you through all the levels of the practice. But tonight I'd like to talk in particular about a level that tends to be overlooked, which is what the Buddha called merit. The Pali word is punya. And this is the first answer to that question. The things that you do that will lead to long-term welfare and happiness. Now, the idea of merit is not very popular in Western Buddhism. It sounds like brownie points. And there's a sense that it's, one, it's selfish, you're looking for your own happiness, kind of a mass, kind of a spiritual materialism, which, by the way, however, the Buddha never criticized. He often used the analogy of trying to find inner wealth and amassing inner wealth as an analogy for the practice. And secondly, is that it's only for people who are not really serious about the higher levels of the practice. Neither of those are true. Because what the Buddha is telling you to do, to gain merit, you have to be generous. You have to give, one. Two, you have to be virtuous. You follow the precepts that involve no harming of anyone, no killing, no stealing, no illicit sex, no intoxicants, no lying. And you make sure that you hold to those principles in all situations. That's the practice of virtue. And then there's the development of universal goodwill. When you sit down and meditate and spread thoughts of goodwill to everybody, like we did this evening. All these things are called meritorious practices. And as you can see, there's nothing really selfish about them. It's finding happiness in a way where both sides benefit. When you give to others, they benefit, of course, but you also benefit as well. You develop a state of mind that is more spacious, you have a greater sense of your own well-being, that you were wealthy enough to have something to share. The same with the precepts. You're not harming anyone, so you develop this quality of virtue. Of course, they're not being subjected to your lies or to your acts of killing or to your acts of theft. So other people benefit too. And even more so with thoughts of goodwill. You have to have goodwill for everybody, including politicians you don't like. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as the evening goes on. But there's nothing selfish about these practices. And also, they're not just for people who don't want to go further in the practice, because they teach you a very basic principle, which is that well-being comes from your actions, that something has to be generated from within. And this is giving you practice in doing precisely that. When you think of the Buddhist teachings and the Four Noble Truths, it's basically the principle of your actions and what are you doing and what are the results of your actions. Are you causing suffering with your actions, or are you leading to an end of suffering with your actions? And your actions are the important things. Craving is the action. Clinging is the action that leads to suffering. The Noble Eightfold Path is the path of action that leads to the end of suffering. Something you're going to have to generate from within. And so if you gain some practice in the practice of merit, that gives you a sense of, I am capable of doing this. One of my teachers at John Suwat was leading a retreat in Massachusetts one time. And he looked out across the room one evening, this is at the beginning of the retreat, and as he turned to me, he said, you know, everybody looks awfully grim around here. It was almost as if they had, you know, nirvana or bust wrapped on their foreheads. And he attributed it to the fact that they hadn't had any practice in merit. He says, if you have practice in generosity, practice in virtue, in the way the Buddha teaches that, you begin to realize that these practices, which when you first start them may seem counterintuitive, but they actually do lead to happiness, they do lead to well-being. And you get a sense that you have some control over your life. You can change your life by changing your actions. And that gives you a sense of power. And with that sense of power, then you're ready to try, okay, well, how about this meditation stuff? Maybe this is going to be good as well. Now, there is a tendency in Thailand for people to go as far as generosity and maybe some virtue, but then to forget about the meditation. There is that danger. There was a famous meditation teacher there one time was teaching some of the students and said, you know, if you're just generous, but you don't practice the precepts and you don't meditate, you have a good chance of being reborn as a dog in an American house. It's comfortable, but you don't know much of anything. If you are generous and you observe the precepts, you have a good chance of being born as a human being, wealthy, but you don't have the wisdom to use that wealth well, and it can destroy you. As we see many times around us, people get wealthy, but they just use their wealth in horrible ways, and they end up destroying themselves. If you want to be totally safe, he said, practice generosity and virtue and meditation. Meditation gives you the wisdom to use your wealth well. So this is all part of laying a foundation for being responsible in how you approach your life. So you can take that sense of responsibility and apply it to your meditation. Got my notes here, make sure I don't forget anything. The path that the Buddha will recommend in the Four Noble Truths also includes virtue as one of its factors, so you're already getting practice in that. It also has right effort. Now, then again, this is another issue that many people think the Buddha taught not to have any effort. I just saw an ad for effortless mindfulness meditation on the website. I must admit, if the Buddha were in a grave, he'd be turning around. Because ardency is part of mindfulness. You are mindful that there are things that have to be done to abandon unskillful qualities, to develop skillful ones. And you have to keep that in mind, which is what mindfulness is. And then you develop alertness, which is the quality of watching what you're actually doing. And finally, ardency is you want to do it well. You want to put your whole heart into this. And these are qualities that you'd practice as, say, when you're practicing virtue. You have to keep your precept in mind. You have to remember, okay, I made a promise to myself, and that's what the precepts are, promises to yourself, that I wouldn't lie. And a friend comes up in an ugly dress and says, how do I look? You have to say, okay, how do I get past this without lying? And you can tell yourself, well, she looks better than if she were not wearing a dress, so the dress is fine. When I was teaching in France, I got some questions. They were saying, you know, this precept against alcohol, I mean, it's really going to have to change when it comes to France, because French culture is built around the appreciation of wine. And if someone offers you a glass of wine and you don't accept it, that's an insult. And so I said, look, you can tell them that your doctor says you shouldn't have alcohol, because after all, the Buddha is considered to be a doctor, treats the spiritual ills of the world. And so you don't have to tell exactly who your doctor is or what disease you're treating, but you say, my doctor says no. And that way you can refuse the alcohol. They didn't give up easily. The next day I got a question on the table, a fine piece of camembert au point. Fresh bread right out of the oven, still warm and crusty. About a bottle of Pommard, which I had never heard of before, but apparently is extremely expensive wine, open and ready to pour. Would my doctor recommend Diet Coke? And I said no. The Buddha was not an American capitalist, he'd recommend San Pellegrino. So when you're practicing the precepts, it's not that you're just saying, oh, I'm just going to follow the rules and regardless. There are times when you have to figure out, how do I follow the rule and not cause trouble? So you're developing alertness and ardency, and you're developing your discernment at the same time. We'll get into this more as we go more into the precepts. But this right effort to do these things is based on desire. The Buddha doesn't say all desire is bad. He says the desire to put it into suffering is actually part of the path. The desire to develop skillful qualities is actually part of the path. The desire to abandon unskillful ones is part of the path. You have to nurture this kind of desire as part of right effort. There was a Brahmin who came to see Ananda one time. And he said, this path that you're following here, what is its goal? And as Ananda said, one of its goals is to put an end to desire. And the Brahmin said, well, how do you do that? And Ananda taught a teaching which is called the Four Bases of Power, which are basically different ways of developing concentration. And one of them is desire. And so the Brahmin said, no, wait a minute, you can't end desire through desire. And then Ananda said, well, when you came here to this park where I'm staying right now, before you came, didn't you have the desire to come? And the Brahmin said, yes. Well, now that you're here, where's that desire? It's gone. Because it's fulfilled. And it's the same way. The desire is to gain the end of suffering is part of the path. It will be dropped as the path yields its results. But you can't have the path without desire. And so the desire to be generous, the desire to be virtuous, the desire to develop a happiness that is long-lasting and harmless is a desire you want to encourage, something that you want to hold on to. And John Cha has a really good analogy for this. He says it's like you're coming back from a market and you're holding a banana in your hand. And someone comes up to you and says, why are you carrying the banana? And you say, because I'm going to eat it. Are you going to eat the peel too? No. Then why are you carrying the peel? And John Cha says, okay, how would you answer this person? And it's interesting, his answer comes in two layers. The first answer, he says, is first you have to have the desire to come up with a good answer. So you answer with desire. And then two, of course, the answer is because the time hasn't come to let go of the peel yet. If I let go of the peel now, the banana will be mush in my hands. So you hold on to the peel as long as you need it. The same way with the practice, practicing virtue, practicing all the various forms of merit, the various parts of the path, and the desire to do all this. You hold on to this as part of maintaining your path. Otherwise, your mind becomes mush. When the time comes to let these things go, you will let them go. So these are things that you hold on to in the meantime because they deliver you to where you want to go. The development of merit also corresponds to the Buddhist teachings on mindfulness as what he calls a governing principle, the principle that kind of looks after the rest of the path. And it's very interesting considering that mindfulness is sometimes taught as being just with whatever arises and passes away and being okay with whatever arises and passes away. It's not what the Buddha taught. Remember, mindfulness for him is a quality of the memory. There are things you keep in mind, and one of the things you keep in mind is if there's something that's skillful that you haven't developed yet, you try to give rise to it. If there's something skillful that's there, you try to maintain it. In other words, you try to give rise to things and you try to stop them from passing away. So it's not just passively watching and accepting, you're actually more actively involved. And again, the practice of merit is something that gets you more actively involved in looking for a genuine happiness. And finally, in terms of developing concentration, the Buddha said, if you're stingy, you cannot get into good concentration. So generosity is kind of a prerequisite for the path, one that you want to develop and develop. One of the ways the Buddha has you use this is a reflection he calls the recollection of generosity, which is when times when your mind is feeling kind of arid and dry on the path, he has you stop and think, you know, I have been generous in the past. That's a good quality. I have good qualities within me. And that gives you a sense of self-esteem and a sense of encouragement on the path. It helps that if you don't have just one act of generosity in your life, and you can milk that for a little bit. Which is why generosity has to be a constant practice. So let's look a little bit at generosity. For the Buddha, when he taught about what he called mundane right view, which is the kind of right view that begins to get you on the path, the very first thing he says is, there is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. Now that sounds pretty obvious. I mean, you see people giving things around there. But the Buddha was actually addressing a deeper issue than that, which was that in India, for millennia, the Brahmins had been in charge of teaching people. And one of the things they taught was people should be generous to Brahmins. They actually had funeral services where the Brahmins would say, okay, now we are now speaking to you in the voice of the people who have passed on. Give to the Brahmins. And then after the people who were sponsoring the funeral gave to the Brahmins, then they said, give more. It was written into the funeral service. Now you can imagine, after 1,000 years of this, people got kind of tired of it. And so there was a reaction, people saying that generosity really doesn't accomplish anything, and it really doesn't count as generosity at all. And the two reasons that were given for this, one was that everything was predetermined in life, that there are forces outside you that determined everything that you were going to do, that you had no freedom of will, no choice at all. And therefore, when people are generous, they have no choice, so there's no virtue in generosity. That was one argument. The other argument was that, well, people die, they just disappear, they turn into nothing anyhow. So no matter what you give them, it all turns into nothingness in the end. So why bother? And so when the Buddha was saying, there is what is given, he was basically countering those two arguments. He was saying, one, people do have freedom of choice, and so there is virtue when people decide to share something of theirs that they didn't have to. And then two, there is more to you than just this body. There's something that passes on. And so contributing to that passing on is actually something worthwhile. So basically when the Buddha is talking about generosity, he talks about freedom of choice, that you have the choice to be generous. This is one of the reasons why in Buddhist culture there's a lot of protection around this freedom of choice. When the Buddha talked about generosity, it wasn't before people gave, it was after. In other words, he wouldn't get up and give a Dhamma talk and say, okay, Dhamma is a 2,500-year-old tradition, whatever. He would wait until after you'd already given and then talk about the virtue of generosity so you would rejoice in the fact that you have been generous. And one time this king came to, again, it was Basanati, King Basanati, came to see the Buddha and asked him, where should a gift be given? And after the Brahmin saying the gifts should be given to Brahmins, and the Jain saying gifts should be given to the Jains, he expected the Buddha to say give to the Buddhists. And the Buddha didn't say that at all. He says, give where you feel inspired, or you feel it would be well used. That was it. So in other words, you are free to give wherever you want. And the Buddha actually wrote that into the monks' rules. When someone asks us, where should we give? We're supposed to say, give where you feel inspired, where you feel the gift would be well used or well taken care of. I had a case one time years back when someone I knew called up and said his mother was planning to give a very large gift to a Dharma center. And she was trying to decide whether to give it to our monastery or to another center. And he said, what should I say to her? And so I heard myself say, give where you feel inspired or you feel it would be well used. So she felt it would be well used the other place. But it was a very large sum of money, and so I said to myself, okay, my virtue is worth more than that sum of money. That felt good. So when you give freely, you realize it, you have the power to change the world around you, and it creates a sense of spaciousness in the mind. As I said earlier, you have the sense that you are wealthy enough to share. You have enough wealth that you can give to someone else. So you have that sense of, okay, I can create the world around me, and I can create it to be a better place. I can give rise to goodness from within. This is a source of genuine self-esteem, and this applies to all the forms of merit. You realize it's a choice I had to make. I could have not done it, but I did it. I may have had to overcome some resistance, but I went ahead and did it anyhow. There's a famous story in the commentaries of this very poor man and his wife. And they had only one upper robe. Now, back in those days, if you went outside, you didn't go out without an upper robe on, men or women. And so they had only one upper robe to share. And so when she left the house, he had to stay in the house, and vice versa. And so one night, the Buddha's going to be giving a Dhamma talk, and so they decide that the husband should go that night. And so he gets there, and the Buddha's talking about generosity. And this man is thinking to himself, gee, this is why we're so poor. We've never been generous in our lives. And he thinks about, what do I have to give? I have nothing except this upper robe. He fights back and forth, back and forth, back and forth all night. And the Buddha keeps giving a talk, giving a talk, giving a talk. And finally the man stands up and says, victory! And he comes out and gives the robe to the Buddha. And back in those days, you didn't shout victory unless you were king. And the king happens to be in the audience. Okay, wait, but who's shouting victory here? And so the king finds out about this guy, that he has only one robe, and he gave it to the Buddha. So the Buddha gives him lots of robes. So the guy gives that to the Buddha, and the Buddha, then he gives more and more and more stuff to the Buddha. And finally the king says, okay, that's enough. And so the guy takes some of the stuff that the king gave and gives the rest to the Buddha. And the Buddha commented afterwards, you know, if he'd given at the earlier part of the evening, he probably would have gotten more. So there is something that sometimes you have to overcome. But when you realize that you have overcome it, there is a sense of victory. There's a sense of self-esteem. I have given rise to goodness within myself. And that comes from being generous. Now, although the Buddha said that you should give where you feel inspired, he said there is a skill to giving if you want to get the best results. It depends on four factors. The first factor is your motivation. Why are you giving? He talks about the lowest motivation, of course, is I will get this back. Or sometimes with interest. Moving up from that, giving is good. It's a good thing to do. I want to give. Moving higher than that, I am well off. There are these other people who are not well off. It would not be good for me not to give them something. A higher motivation than that is simply, it's a natural expression of the mind. The mind has developed this generosity to the point where it just naturally wants to give. It's these higher forms of motivation. In terms of your attitude, that's the second factor, the attitude you bring to it. The one you give with a sense of respect for the recipient. Even though you may be wealthier than that person is now, you don't know this has always been the case, or always will be the case. As the Buddha said, when you see someone who is very, very poor, remind yourself, you've been there before. If you see someone who's very wealthy, you've been there before. So there should be no jealousy for wealthy people and no condescension to poor people. So you give with respect. You give with an attitude of sympathy for that person's well-being. You give it with the belief that something will come of this. You're not tossing things away, that there is a goodness that will be developed through this. And as the Buddha said, you have to have your mind glad before you're doing it, serene while you're doing it, and gratified afterwards, happy that you did it. If you can keep that attitude all the way through, then the gift becomes a gift with a lot of potential. It accomplishes a lot. There's a story in the canon of this one man who gave a gift to a private Buddha, and then afterwards regretted it. He said, I could have given that to somebody else. And so when he was reborn, he was born very wealthy, but he couldn't use his wealth. He had a nice carrot chariot, but he'd get sick and get dizzy riding the chariot, so he had to walk. He had nice food, but if he ate the nice food, he would throw up, so he had to eat poor food. He had a nice house, but he couldn't live in the house. In other words, if you're not happy about your gift, that decreases the amount of the merit that comes from it. So you're trying to make sure that your mind is happy as you do this all the way through. The third factor is the recipient of the gift. As the Buddha said, you try to find someone who will make good use of the gift, ideally someone whose mind is free from passion, aversion, and delusion, or is practicing that direction. That gives the highest results of the gift. And finally, the gift itself. This doesn't have to do with the monetary value. It has to do more with the fact that it's a timely gift and that you're not harming anybody in doing this. You're not harming yourself, you're not harming others in giving that particular gift. Because the gift here doesn't have to be a material thing. It can be a gift of your time, it can be a gift of your energy, a gift of your forgiveness, a gift of being fair to other people. All of these things count as generosity. In fact, generosity of the forms of merit is the one that's most amenable to being creative, giving ways that you actually feel, I'd really like to give this gift. This is one of the things I noticed when I was in Thailand. People would put a lot of thought into what kind of gift do I want to give? And they were very imaginative often in the types of gifts they would give, because this would be their way of expressing themselves. So that's generosity. The second form of merit is the virtue, which comes, as I said, come down to the precepts. And these precepts are healing to the mind, because they deal with one of the big problems is when you know that you've harmed somebody, there's either regret or denial. And if you sit down and try to meditate with a lot of regret, it's hard to get the mind to settle down, because all you can think about is how you wish you hadn't done that. Or you develop, this is like a wound. Either it's an open wound of regret, or you develop some really hard scar tissue over the wound. That's the denial. You know, I didn't do any wrong. That person doesn't matter anyhow. What I did didn't count as anything bad. I did it for a higher purpose. All these kinds of denial that you actually did something wrong. And if the mind is full of denial, you're not going to gain any insight into the mind. It's going to be closed up. So for the purpose of getting the mind to settle down so you can understand yourself, the precepts are good for healing this. Because if you don't do wrong, then you don't have to deal with regret afterwards. The Buddha actually calls the virtue a treasure. Once heard a soldier a veteran from Vietnam, talking about how he'd killed a young woman totally senselessly and totally purposely in the war. And that it haunted him for the rest of his life. And he said, if I could have $1 million, I'd pay to go back and undo that. Well, of course, not even $1 million can do that. But if you have the virtues to not go ahead and make these mistakes to begin with, you have something that's worth a lot. Because it protects your mind. And some people complain about the precepts that they're hard and fast rules. I think a better way of thinking of it is they're clear cut. You know, no killing, period. No stealing, period. Because it's when you are face to face with situations where you really do feel tempted to steal or to kill, it's good to have something, you know, clear and short to keep in mind. It's like those signs they had for bear awareness up in Alaska. Did you ever see those? They're basically the do's and don'ts for dealing with bears. And, you know, the first one is they're all counterintuitive. When you see a bear, don't run. You know, raise your hands high above your head. Speak to the bear in a calm, reassuring voice. It's all very short, clear cut kind of things, because when you're face to face with a bear, you're not going to remember anything sort of long and complicated. And it's the same when you're face to face with the temptation to kill or to steal or to lie. No, just keep it as a no. And it's clear cut and it's very easy to remember. The Buddha's talking about here, when the precepts, he's talking about things that you focus on that are under your control. It's primarily what you do or what you directly tell other people to do. Those are things you can't control in your life. And so you can focus on that. There's sometimes the issue comes up that with the precept against killing, is it okay to eat meat? And as far as the precept is concerned, it's okay. Now, if you want to go to a greater level of refinement than that, then you can become vegetarian. But the precept itself is focusing. It said, first look at what you are doing yourself, what you actually tell other people to do. Make sure you clean up that. And then focus on the further ramifications of your actions. The precepts are also humane, that you're not harming yourself by breaking the precepts, and you don't harm others by getting them to break precepts. I think that's an interesting concept, that harming other people is not killing them so much as it is getting them to kill, getting them to steal, getting them to lie. Because they're developing the karma that's going to be their karma from that point on. And so you're humane both in your treatment of yourself and your treatment of other people. And as I said earlier, you develop mindfulness through the practice of the precepts. You have to keep them in mind. You have to be alert to what you're doing with your actions, to make sure they are in line with the precepts. And then finally, there's this quality of ardency, that when it's difficult to hold to the precept, how do you make sure that you hold to it, keep with it? And that gives you a sense of, again, this sense of self-esteem, that you can overcome your resistance to doing what's good, doing what's right. And that you can give rise, as I said, to goodness within you. Finally, the third form of merit is development of limitless goodwill. This is the word metta, which is sometimes defined as loving kindness, but closer to what the original meaning is, just simple goodwill. There's a passage where the Buddha says, you know, it's, even if bandits have pinned you down and they're sawing off your limbs with a two-handled saw, you still have to have metta for them. Now, you're not going to have loving kindness for those bandits, but you don't have goodwill. You want to maintain that goodwill in that state. My teacher, John Fuhr, told the story. One time he was living in a hut, and a snake moved into the hut as well. And so he decided to test himself. Can I live in the hut with the snake and not be afraid of the snake? And so every day he would come into the hut, and the snake would slip behind a little cabinet he had. And he finally got to the point where he said, okay, he was not afraid of the snake. He had no ill will for the snake. But he realized, okay, this one night he said, okay, enough. He sat and meditated, and in his mind said to the snake, he said, okay, it's not that I don't like you or I don't have goodwill for you, but we are different species, and misunderstandings between different species are very easy. There's plenty of space out there in the forest for you to live and be happy. And so the snake left. So that was his expression of goodwill. The snake didn't want his loving kindness. He just wanted goodwill. And so this is what we're talking about. There is that passage in the canon that sometimes is translated as saying, just as a mother would give her life to protect her only child, so you should cherish all living beings. And the actual passage does not say that. It says, just as the mother would protect her child, so you should protect your goodwill. You can't go around cherishing and protecting all living beings, because you drive yourself to a frazzle. You can't protect your goodwill. It may not be easy, but it's something you can work on. It's something you want to maintain in all situations, especially when it's difficult. Because you're doing this not so much for the other person, you're doing it for yourself. You want to make sure that you can trust yourself to behave skillfully even in difficult situations. And it's a lot easier if you have goodwill even for the person who's abusive to other people or who's been harsh or cruel to other people. Maybe you can figure out what would be the right thing to say or right thing to think if you have that person's good with that person's true well-being in mind. So you're doing it for yourself. You're not doing it because you recognize the Buddha nature in the other person or the oneness that you have with the other person. That's not the motivation. The motivation is, I've got to protect my actions. The Buddha actually talks about this as a form of restraint. I will not do anything to harm. Because it's not just the attitude of goodwill, it actually has to be carried out in your actions. Now, it is something that you have to develop. We may have goodwill for certain beings, but to have goodwill for everybody does not come innately to us. Ill will is just as innate as goodwill. So we have to develop. As the Buddha said, it's a determination, something you make up your mind. This is something I want to work on. And then you have to keep it in mind. It's another form of mindfulness. I've got to maintain this in mind. So when driving down the road after the talk tonight, and somebody cuts in front of you, don't let your goodwill jump out the window. Okay, goodwill, even for the idiots on the road. And this doesn't mean you don't recognize that there are idiots on the road. There are idiots on the road, but you have to have goodwill for them. Okay. The Buddha's not saying you have to like the person you have goodwill for. Just that, okay, I will not harm this person. I will do nothing to harm this person. Because after all, what are you wishing for? You're wishing for, as I said earlier, that the person will understand the causes for true happiness and act on it. Because we are, as we've been learning through the development of merit, your happiness depends on your actions, so you're hoping that other person will act in a way that will lead to happiness. Years back, I was talking to a woman up in San Francisco, and she was having a problem with her landlord. The landlord was about to sell the property, and he wanted all the tenants to lie about the rent they were paying to the new buyer. And he was going around to each tenant one by one by one and asking them to lie. And she was saying, this is driving me crazy. I sit there wishing him goodwill. I imagine him with, you know, many girlfriends and a swimming pool and a car. And said, no. That's not goodwill. Goodwill is the wishes person would stop trying to make us want us to lie, okay? And you say that to yourself, that I want to make sure this person doesn't create the bad karma of lying. And then you get together with the other tenants and you approach them all as a group. She was a student of another branch of Buddhism. She said, this is what I like about you, Theravada. You're so practical. And when you look at the Buddha's goodwill phrases, and among them are these, may these beings look after themselves with ease. And what you're saying, may they be there for themselves. You're not saying, may I be there for them. May they be there for themselves. Another one is, let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere or through anger or wish for another to suffer. In other words, may these persons act on the causes of true happiness and act on this on restraint from harm. Of these forms of merit, generosity, virtue, and goodwill, the Buddha says that goodwill compared to the others is like the moon compared to the stars. In other words, goodwill is the big one. It's what gives energy to the rest and gives the motivation for the rest. However, you can imagine the night sky without any stars and just a moon. It's good to have the stars as well. It's good to have the virtue and good to have the generosity, especially when goodwill is not just an attitude, it's something you want to have bringing into your actions. And generosity and virtue are how you do this. The lessons you learn from merit is primarily happiness is not a zero-sum game. In other words, it doesn't have to be the case that you gain something and somebody else loses. These are ways of happiness where you benefit, the people around you benefit as well. This erases boundaries among us. I mean, if your happiness is based on living in your gated community and keeping everybody else out, there's going to be a lot of divisiveness. People resent what you've got. But if you're trying to be happy by giving to other people, nobody's going to resent your happiness. And there's no boundary to that happiness. It erases the boundaries among us. The same with virtue, the same with goodwill. It also teaches you the importance of intention. You are creating your world through your actions. You want to create a good world, a spacious world, a world without boundaries, like this. And then finally, it gives you a good source of self-esteem. Not the sort of self-esteem that comes from, you know, gold stars on your papers when you're a student. It's a self-esteem that I can give rise to goodness within me. I can overcome my less skillful attitudes. And I can give rise to this goodness. It doesn't depend on anybody else outside. It's something I can generate from within. That's where true self-esteem comes. And that's the kind of self-esteem you need in order to practice. Now, the word goodness is something you don't hear much in our country. Just for the fun of it, one time I got online, I went onto Amazon, and I put in goodness in the search box. And all the books were about baked goods. Which says something. But what the Buddha here is talking about, again, the word bunya, merit, I wish we could find another translation for it. Maybe goodness is the way to translate it. You're giving rise to goodness. He said this is another word for happiness, these acts of merit. But you are giving rise to a quality of goodness, which feels good inside. The goodness spreads around. And it gives you the practice you need to develop the higher levels of the practice. It gets you practice in the Eightfold Path and realizing, okay, the question between happiness and suffering does depend on my actions. And it gives you further and further practice in finding what will lead to longer and better, truer forms of happiness. But this, the practice of merit is what gets you started in the right direction. So those are my thoughts for tonight. Do you have any questions? Yes.
That guided meditation, I don't know, the body asleep, paying attention. I mean, I tried to do it, but because I practiced it, I couldn't do it. If I keep practicing, will I actually be able to have my awareness go to my fingertips?
Yes, yes. It takes a while, but yes, you can get used to it. And the whole purpose of this is to get you more sensitive to what's going on inside. And the more you can relax the various parts, kinds of tension there in the body, the easier it is to settle down and feel a sense of well-being there. I was just kind of running it through it fast. It took me a long time to get too good at this, but it is, with practice it gets easier. It gets more pleasant. There's a book in the library, we brought some copies, it's called With Each and Every Breath. And it basically teaches this method. Yes.
When I practice metta meditation, mm-hmm. I like to bring an image of a person into the center of my chest mm-hmm. and really feel the feeling. And when I say words like, may this person be happy, peaceful, that seems to distract from that. So I tend to, after a while, I drop the words and just focus on
that's perfectly fine. Yes.
I often read the news and find myself angry and upset. Is the solution to that to read less or to do some meditative exercises on this anger?
What I do is read less. realizing that what the news is telling you is that the important things in the world are things that other people are doing someplace else. And what the practice is telling you is that what's important as well is what you're doing right now. And so you don't want to clutter up that with the stuff that other people are doing. Now you may decide that if you want to have a part of your generosity would be, say, to do some social action. You might want to read up on the issues that are directly related to what your particular project is. But as for everything else, you have to really develop equanimity and realize that this is the human condition. I was in the doctor's office the other day. I don't know what the doctor was thinking. He was had a copy of Natural History magazine in there, and they had a special issue devoted to plagues. And you read about millions and millions of people dying. And you realize how many times that has happened in the human world. And so the human world is, it's always been a difficult place. There's always been death, aging, illness, and crazy people. And you have to say, in the midst of all that, I have to make sure that my practice stays stellar. There's a story in the canon where, again, King Basanity is coming to see the Buddha in the middle of the day. And the Buddha asks him, where are you coming from today? And the king says, well, just engaging the typical things that people mad about power engage in. And it's remarkably frank. Can you imagine our president being that frank about it? And the Buddha says, suppose a reliable man were to come from the east and say there's this huge mountain moving in from the east, crushing all living beings in its path. And there's another reliable man comes from the south, so another mountain moving in from the south. There's another mountain moving in from the west, another one moving in from the north. And given that human life is so precious and so fleeting, what would you do in the midst of all this destruction? And the king said, well, what else can I do but calm my mind and practice the Dharma? And the Buddha said, I'm telling you, aging, illness, and death are moving in. So what do you do? Calm my mind and practice the Dharma. So it doesn't matter which politicians are riding the mountains. The mountains are moving in. So you've got to keep that attitude.
Thanks for coming to San Diego. Appreciate it.
I am in San Diego.
I have a question. I have a question about the practice. So, like some days, like maybe I'll set like an hour timer and just do like a body scan or metta. And then before I know it, like the timer's off and I haven't had any time to really focus on like developing concentration better or vipassana. So I was curious if it's like a skillful move to have maybe one day of just really trying to cultivate like concentration and insight, and then maybe one day of just metta, maybe one day of...
Sure.
Okay.
It's perfectly fine.
Thanks.
I was trying to do some reading about your past and what you've done. And there's a word that came a couple of times, deathless. Mm-hmm. Throughout your 22, 25 years that you were studying, the practice of your traditions to stop deathless, and I couldn't understand that.
It's to find the deathless.
Well, the only meaning I was able to find is the mind free of suffering and sense of self. What did that mean?
It
came across many times.
There's a deathless dimension that the mind can attain or can contact through the practice. And there's, in this dimension, there's no time, there's no space, but there's no change. And in getting there, you have to develop concentration, you have to develop insight. And there are a lot of things that you're going to be giving up. But then you realize, okay, there is this thing that can be contacted through the mind that doesn't change, it doesn't die. And that's what the purpose of the practice is. I mean, the deathless is another word for nirvana.
May I ask you, throughout those 22 years, how long did it take you to actually accomplish that?
Monks aren't supposed to talk about their attainments. I think I've been practicing more than 22 years.
But your studies are about 22, 25 years. So.
I've been a monk for 40 years.
It's all Google.
It's all Google. Oh my gosh. Well, not everything Uncle Guru teaches you, is this? Yes.
Thank you. My question is this. I've recently had the observation that people who are monastics or taking it very seriously seem to me to be at times almost in a funk, almost like, I suppose I go into this, and this is probably my fault, thinking that, you know, there'd be this gentle smile, and, you know, and it doesn't seem, in my experience, throughout different Buddhist practices, and I've heard that at retreats, and you mentioned a little bit that there's a little bit of almost real seriousness. I was wondering, does that change the more you practice? Like once you attain stream entry or a different ways of...
Are we in a funk at the moment here?
it's my perception, but I don't know what that is.
Well, I mean, there are monks and they're monks. I mean, in the very beginning, it's very... I mean, you realize you've taken on a big task. And there are many times when it seems daunting. But as you actually get better at the practice, I mean, it's a great sense of joy. And as for the gentle smile, my teacher could be gentle, he could also be very harsh. As you know, circumstances required. But for me, I wouldn't trade this for any other life.
I guess I lived in New York City for a while. And
any monk in New York City is going to be in a funk.
I suppose that, I mean, the people in New York seem to be very grave, mm-hmm. but if you actually just speak to them, they're very open mm-hmm. and helpful. And mm-hmm. So I wonder if it's something like that.
Maybe, I don't know. Yes.
What's your daily practice look like?
What does it look like? Up around 4. meditate until 6, and then morning chores until about 8:30, alms round, meal. And then after that, more time to meditate. I take a little time off every day to do a little writing. And then evening chores, Dharma talk, meditation in the evening. That's the day. Yes?
What does the dragon represent within Buddhism?
What is the what?
The dragon.
The dragon. Well, they have, in Chinese Buddhism, you have to ask a Chinese Buddhist. In Thailand, they have a version that's kind of like a dragon. They call it a naga. It's a serpent. And it represents the protective forces of nature protecting Buddhism. I mean, the story goes that when the Buddha gained awakening, there was a big storm about 2 weeks after his awakening. And this naga came up and coiled itself around him, spread his head over the top to protect him. Which is why you see these images, you know, with the naga sitting over the Buddha. So it's kind of protected. But they symbolize the forces of nature. Yes.
I heard that, you know, a country or a nation, community can have, or society can have karma. And I'm just curious what your take is on our current political climate. Is that our nation's karma?
It's our karma as individuals.
Okay. And the way we respond to it.
And each of us, the way we respond to it, and the fact that we're living in this situation, we all have certain karma in common from the past, but it doesn't mean that we all did it at the same time together. It's each of us has that particular karma from someplace in the past that we have to be here subjected to this stuff right now.
You talked about many virtues. Where does the virtue of hope fit?
The virtue of hope? Hope in the sense that an end to suffering is possible. And that you can do it. And that's part of the motivation for the path. And the Buddha keeps saying that it is possible to do this. I mean, the idea that Buddhism is pessimistic is just way off. The Buddha said that what we have right here it is as good as it gets. He never says that. There's something much better than this. But then the hope is, I hope I will live long enough so I can practice that. And that's an uncertain thing. So the Buddha doesn't use the word hope that much. Puts more on desire and the different factors of motivation, determination. Because all too often hope has to do with, I hope somebody else will do something. But this is, I'm going to give rise to what I need to give rise to right now. That's the attitude that he has developed. Yes.
You talked about how much of your daily practice is meditation. Mm-hmm. Do you go into each meditation with an intention? Does that intention vary from one sitting to the next?
Yeah, it depends on whether you're going to focus more on getting the mind quiet, or if you've got a problem with pain, so what do you deal with the pain today? Depends on what you find is necessary, yeah. Because the whole point of concentration practice is to have an intention and stick with it. Yes.
Do you have to focus on, like, you know, how the mind races, you know, like just during the day, mm-hmm. and the mind going like to the past or going to the future, and how do you overcome that? Or do you have that?
Well, you try to get as comfortable as possible in the body with the breath energy, because you find that a lot of the racing has to do with the fact I don't feel comfortable here. I'm going to find someplace else.
But even if I'm just talking about like every day, you know, your functioning, mm-hmm. every day functioning, the mind got races. So how do you stop from like racing, not when you're just sitting meditating?
Well, you do the same thing. You try to create that sense of well-being as you go through the day. It's because what you're doing on what I led you through here now is not just for sitting with your eyes closed. You're trying to develop a sense of well-being in the body, and you learn how to do this. It's like walking and chewing gum at the same time, you know. You walk around and you work with your breath energy at the same time. Now, as a monk, I have a lot less sort of, you know, distractions in the course of the day. But I found that it is possible you can stay centered as you go through the day. And you don't have to worry about this, you know, thoughts racing out of control. Because they're your thoughts are looking for a little bite of pleasure. And say, okay, I'll give this right here. Yes.
I remember before on access to insight, and I think that you said when people ask you, how do I get my kid to be Buddhist, you said, don't.
That's somebody else.
No. Okay. Well, I had this situation the other night where some family members watched our kids, and our kids having sleeping problems, and in the middle of the night, one of our family members took it upon herself to teach her some religion. Mm-hmm. You were created by so-and-so, and I don't have a problem with that, but that's just not your place. Mm-hmm. So we drew a boundary. But afterwards, I was thinking, there was a little bit of a sense of ease that came from her getting told this, mm-hmm. and she went to sleep. Mm-hmm. Is there, I have a hard time finding, find refuge in your actions or something like that.
Yeah.
4-year-old. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in Thailand, what they do is think about how much you love your mother, how much you love your father, and how happy you are you were together with them. That's beginning practice in goodwill. And they do talk about refuge in the Buddha. And when they teach little kids that, they don't go into a lot of detail about it. You take refuge in the Buddha by imitating the Buddha and becoming like the Buddha. It's more, okay, there's the Buddha there, who's a great man, who's teaching us to be good people. And he's our refuge. And so the kid can conceive refuge in any way he or she would like. But you've got to give the kid something, to hold on to. And Buddhism is a really good something to hold on to. And it's a basic practice in generosity, basic practice in gratitude, goodwill. I mean, all these, you don't lie, you're beginning to teach the kid merit from the very beginning. Because every child needs that as kind of a sense of being anchored. And so when the aunt comes in and says, you were made by so-and-so, I said, well, I don't think so.
Santa Claus. I mean, you're teaching good and bad actions, but in the end...
You're lying, yeah. I know. As a child, I figured out Santa Claus pretty quickly. And it was because of my mother. I left some cookies and some milk on the mantelpiece. We actually had an old-fashioned fireplace with a mantelpiece and everything, so I left some cookies and milk for Santa Claus. And Santa Claus wrote a note. The problem was Santa Claus's handwriting was just like my mother's. And I was not fooled. So I lived perfectly well from age 4 on without believing in Santa Claus.
Sorry if I misquoted you for saying that before.
No, I teach you to be Buddhist. I mean, if they're going to have to react against something, that's a good thing to react against. Because they find themselves, after all, they have to come back.
Yes. Could you speak a little bit about how to get better at noticing when your equanimity is drifting into apathy and indifference?
Okay. You have to ask yourself, I'm feeling cognitive here, the whole purpose of equanimity is so I can put aside my concern about someone's being happy, so I can direct at somebody where it actually would be beneficial. And ask yourself, okay, where is my goodwill focused now? I mean, is this just general apathy about the whole human race? Okay, that's a bad sign. But if you say I have to be equanimous about certain people, what certain people are doing, so that I can focus my goodwill where it would get the most benefit. So be very clear about where your goodwill is going. Everybody satisfied? Oh.
So I have one more question. So a lot of times I'll start the morning listening to one of your short morning Dharma talks and then do a meditation. A lot of times it's you say, like, start with thoughts of goodwill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a morning person. And when I try, like, starting with, like, metta, mm-hmm. it's, like, it's super difficult. Mm-hmm. And, like, especially if, like, I start going towards people I'm not super stoked on at the time, like, mm-hmm. boss. Mm-hmm. I'm just, like, it, like, creates a storm. And, like, I'm like,
mm-hmm. okay, then please focus on your breath first.
Okay.
And then as you're coming out, think about, okay, I've got to be nice to, well, I have to have goodwill for my boss. You always start with something that you find conducive to settling down.
Okay.
That's going to be different for different people. So I tailor things to your needs.
Awesome. Thank you.
Is that it? Yes.
Thank you for your Dharma talk. You said really well how goodwill can help us kind of remove the boundaries between ourselves and others. Could you explain that again?
Okay, but all the practices of merit, generosity, virtue, it's because you're doing something for someone else and both sides are benefiting from it. And that's what puts the boundary down. You know, if you're gaining and I'm losing, there's a big boundary right there. But your both sides are gaining. And in Thailand, when the kind of the culture around monasteries, it's like a big extended family. You know, it's within families, as people exchange gifts, and there's no sense, well, I have to do this for you and you're trying to return doing this for me. But since it's part of the family, it's all considered, it's all part of us benefiting ourselves. And that's what generosity does. We're all kind of in this together. We're all in this happiness together. It's not that I'm gaining and you're losing, or vice versa. It's the same with the precepts. I'm looking after protecting you. I'm not going to kill you, so you don't fear any, you have to fear any danger from me. Again, that erases a boundary. And then, of course, with goodwill, okay, goodwill without exception to everybody. You think about all the types of people and all, everybody, okay, goodwill for them all. That takes the attitude. Okay, we're all in this together. So it erases the boundaries. Yes?
So you mentioned finding a sense of ease and comfort in your body, that if you deal with chronic pain, and even the most comfortable posture, like I typically meditate laying down at home, but even within that posture, there's still often a certain amount of pain. And I've tried a lot of different things, but I'm just wondering what you recommend for dealing.
Well, first, just is it the whole body in pain?
Usually more specific areas.
Yeah. Try to focus on the areas that are not in pain. That requires a certain, you know, determination of will. I'm not going to go straight to the pain, I'm going to go to the areas that are more neutral. And try to develop a sense of well-being there. And then when you have that as your foundation, and if that seems difficult, then you can think about kind of the space immediately around the body. And that you're going to occupy that space. And there's a sense of ease there. And then you can move into the areas where there's pain. And then start looking at what kind of perceptions you have around the pain. You know, do you perceive the pain as being the same thing as that part of the body? Or can you see them as it's on a different frequency, it's in the same place, but in a different frequency, kind of like the different radio waves going through the room right now. You've got Tijuana, we've got San Diego, we've got Los Angeles coming through. But, you know, if you tune into a different frequency, you get a different message. So the body can be just the fact that it's solid and there's energy there, but the pain is something else. And if you learn to see that way, and kind of question the, often we bring attitudes to pain that we picked up way back even before we knew language. So we got some very strange ideas about pain. So you might ask some strange questions about it. You know, does the pain have a bad intention toward you? You might find deep down in your mind there's an attitude, yeah, the pain wants to hurt me. So no, pain has no intention at all. Is the pain solid or does it move? When there are these little moments of pain, are they coming at you or can you think of them going away? I found that one especially helpful. It's kind of like being in the back of one of those old-fashioned station wagons that had the seat that faces back. And as you're riding down the road, as soon as anything comes into your range of vision, it's going away. So if you can think of those moments of pain as, this is why it's going away, it's going away, it's not coming at me, it's a lot easier to live with. And you begin to realize a lot of the reason why the physical pain becomes mental pain is because of your perceptions. But first, to get there, you have to say, okay, there must be some place in the body where I'm relatively okay. Learn to focus there and maximize that. See if that helps.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. It has to do with the workplace. I work in a very small department, and there's a certain person that, not a manager, but they're kind of like a department team leader. And I've noticed since he received that title, it's kind of been a little bit lazier than usual. I've been advised from some of my spiritual mentors to, pray for his happiness, mm-hmm. health, and well-being. And I've been doing that continuously, and it's like I'm trying to learn the difference between, certainly I want good will for this person, but there's sometimes where it's like, sometimes it doesn't come natural to me if I don't work at it, or mm-hmm. practice. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, am I to be a doormat? I mean, I'm not, I know that's not what Buddhism promotes, but it's just like trying to find an equilibrium around, walking the path, but then, where do I?
Okay, you basically, goodwill means you're not going to harm the guy. Of course. But you can criticize. But if you're going to criticize, make sure you're doing it with goodwill. Because the attitude you bring toward that is going to make a difference in how receptive he may be to listening to the criticism. My teacher had a student who was a tailor, or seamstress. And When her clients found out that she liked to meditate, they said, "Well, why are you charging so much for your clothes? People who go to the monastery should be content with whatever they get, right?" And she didn't know how to answer. And so she went to see my teacher and asked him, "How should I respond?" And he said, "Look, tell them I'm not going to the monastery to become stupid." So, there are times when goodwill requires that you be forthright and that you'll be quite stern with somebody. I mean, my teacher was very stern with me. Of course, because he was my teacher, I could put up with it. A team leader, that's harder. But still, if you're going to be critical and you're going to argue with a person, try to do it with an attitude of goodwill. That you're not going to harm this person. You just want to enlighten them. Yes.
Can you describe the experience of stream entry? I'm not necessarily asking your experience.
Just the general generic experience. Okay, the generic experience. It's you get the mind in concentration, and you begin to realize that even in the concentration, there's still stress. And so you try to figure out what's causing the stress. And you're looking kind of for the ups and downs of the stress and the concentration. And you begin to notice, okay, there's a certain perception that goes with the stress, so you drop that perception. And you find yourself going to deeper, deeper, deeper levels of concentration. Finally, you get to one point where you realize no matter what level of concentration you get into, it's still going to be fabricated. And there's a sense of disenchantment with even that kind of pleasure. And then the next question is, if I stay in place, there'll be stress. If I move to something else, there'll be stress. And you have to then there comes a moment where you realize there's another alternative. And things open up. And part of that is you realize that when you come back from it is that the suffering that you've been going through did not start on the date of your birth. This goes way back. This is why stream enters have firm conviction of rebirth. They may not know the details of previous lifetimes, but they realize when you step outside of time. And when you step back into time, you realize, okay, I've been in this little time for a long, 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 long time. And so, which is one of the reasons why stream enters don't want to break the precepts, because they realize that this is what keeps it going. It's breaking the precepts. That's the generic. Yes.
You said you've been a monk for 40 years. Like, in that experience from when you started to where you are now, what's been your biggest takeaway, or not even biggest, but like your favorite thing that you learned?
The things I can't talk about, I'm sorry. The biggest takeaway is that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, and what he said is true.
Say?
What the Buddha said is true. Yes, John?
When you live your life, you depend on other people's generosity mm-hmm. to survive. Mm-hmm. So you can't say, I want this in my bowl, I don't want meat, or I've heard you say that before. How does that come down to if you really do need something?
Well, there are people who will make what they call a bhavananda, which is to make an offer. Say, if you need anything, let me know. And those are cases where you can ask. If someone opens the possibility. And of course, you have to learn how to, not to abuse that, those offers. And so some people will make an offer, and okay, then I can talk, then I can say, well, I actually need this.
They just present it in that way. Mm-hmm. I remember bumping into Tim after he had ordained, and I wanted to be like, hey, do you need anything? You know, but then I held myself back.
Mm-hmm. What you say is, if you need anything, let me know, and then you can put restrictions on that. So he knows what are kind of the limits of that offer. So you could say, do you need anything that doesn't break the bank? I mean, that's actually what some people do. Yeah, this is how much I can afford. Is anything you need? Question over here.
Deception to me feels dirty, that I've been feeding a stray cat and the landlord doesn't want us feeding the stray cat, but it meows at outside, so I keep feeding it.
I would find some way to feed it, yeah, but without the landlord knowing.
Well, I do. I have to sneak. I have to get the plate out under mm-hmm. mud.
Sounds like fun.
No, the landlord went up to check the mail. And I thought she would see the plate hidden. Mm-hmm. So there's deception going on. I don't like it.
You're not saying anything that's a lie.
Well, my other roommate asked if I'm feeding the cat.
Find some way to avoid answering that question. And in particular, one thing is to just say, I'm not available to answer that question right now.
They don't speak that language.
She doesn't, okay. Find out, figure out her equivalent. Yes.
What does it say on developing judgment? Because, you know, an important part of this is that we understand, you know, that we're not just being dictated to by someone telling us what to do, but we develop our own understanding of how you and others have developed the judgment about, you know, guidance from others versus our own sense of judgment. And other things like that if we're following the Dharma, you know, the comparison between intentions and results. Because, we can get states of mind that trick us, right? You know, like the old line about the path to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. You know, how you and others have developed that sense of judgment about how well we're growing in the Dharma and understanding, so we can, have a better sense of it for ourselves and we rely less. on others. What did you say to convey that part?
Well, in the beginning, it's good to find somebody whose sense of judgment you trust and hang around that person so you can see how that person deals with different issues and what that person's standards are. Because that means learning how to judge people. And the Buddha says basically for a teacher, you want to look for someone who doesn't have the greed, aversion, and delusion that would cause them to, one, claim that they knew something that they didn't, and two, that would get them to get you to do something that was not in your best interest. So those are the two guidelines for looking for teachers. And then, as I said, just try to pick up from them, you know, how they look at things, how they question things. And a lot of it has to do with just learning to be really honest with yourself. About, oh, I do this, what are the results? I do that, what are the results? And before you do something, ask yourself, what do I anticipate is going to come about as a result of this action? And if you anticipate any harm, you say, no, I'm not going to do it. That's how you get started.
And then there's also, what do you do with the, when the results don't follow the anticipations, you know, going with the reality, you know, how do you use that help? Realign
ones. Well, just take that as a lesson. Say, look, I've learned the lesson. I thought it was going to be okay, but it was not. And learn, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake again. And talk it over with somebody else who's on the path so we get a different perspective to figure out whether it was something that was beyond your control or something that you actually did could have changed. And then just make your mind, I'm not going to repeat that mistake again. And when something comes out right, learn to pat yourself on the back. So, okay, that worked. So it's not all grim. Yes?
I appreciate the honest appraisal that people do a lot of idiotic things on the road. You know, as long as I'm driving, it's something I struggle with, and I can go from zero to really unhappy because of the way I reacted. And so, is there a little more practical or something, and thinking of goodwill, the way you framed it, maybe just a little reminder that maybe how can I practically apply goodwill that I might see improvement on that?
Okay, well, first have goodwill for yourself, which is that if I let myself get, you know, worked up about this, imagine about more serious things, you know. So I just say, I had a student who was public defender. And she had to defend a couple of kids who had 80 IQ. And she was wondering if she could get them off on the basis of the fact that they had a very low IQ. And so she talked to a psychotherapist, and the therapist says, "Who do you think? I mean, half the people out there in the world are less than 100 IQ." You know? So when you're out on the road, just say, this is the human condition, you know. Mm-hmm. And learn how to drive defensively. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you define dispassion?
Define dispassion? It's basically a sense that you've had enough of something. It's like a food that you've eaten enough so that you don't really want any anymore. You just don't really want to go there. It's like outgrowing a game that used to fascinate you and then it doesn't fascinate you anymore. That's dispassion. Yes?
How do you deal with regret?
You remind yourself, okay, I can't go back and change the past. So have goodwill for the person that you harmed, goodwill for yourself. And they say, okay, I'm just not going to repeat that mistake. And remind yourself that's the best a human being can do. That we've all done lots and lots and lots of mistaken things in the past. And so the best you can do is just resolve, I don't want to repeat that. Okay? Well, thank you for your attention.